I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Rod Mickleburg joins me again. He's just published a new book, On the Line, A History of the British Columbia Labor Movement. It's in the shape of a coffee table book, but it's a more than that. It's a comprehensive chronicle of organized labor in this province. It's got hundreds of photos, some neat shots, some never seen before. Mr. Mickleburg does a fine job in looking at the record of workers fighting against unfair pay and unsafe working conditions. He looks at the politics of this province, often volatile, always colorful. He also casts an eye to the future and where the labor movement is today. Rod Mickleburg is a former labor reporter for the Vancouver Sun Province and a senior writer for the Globe and Mail. With Jeff Meggs, he co-wrote The Art of the Impossible, Dave Barrett, and the NDP in Power, 1972-1975, which he was on this program with in 2012. This new book is published by Harbor. You can follow Rod at Rod Mickleburg is the Twitter handle. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Rod Mickleburg. Mr. Mickleburg, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Very good.
So I was just looking at the notes here. It's about, has it been 6 years since The Art of the Impossible came out?
Is it that?
2012?
You keep better track than I do. It's all a blur.
And you and Megs both have books out this fall.
Well,
spring,
that's
right?
Very interesting, isn't it? And, you know, I don't know how my co-author in The Art of the Impossible, the book on the Barrett years in government, you know, with all the stuff that he's doing, political stuff, finds time to write a book, for goodness sake.
Now, before we get to the new book, I just want to talk about that book for a sec, because that took on a life of its own, didn't it? I mean, everyone read that when that book came out. Everyone bought a copy of the book. And since then, Dave Barrett, of course, has died. It speaks to just how few books there are on BC politics and in BC history, for that matter.
Well, there are books out there, to be frank, but I think the reason Jeff and I wrote that book is because we felt that and it was only 39 months of the Barrett government, BC's first NDP government, had sort of been really neglected by historians and the pundits and so on, and sort of regarded as this kind of blip in BC politics and BC history. But if you really, because, you know, it was a chaotic government, it didn't end happily. I mean, they made blunders, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they were voted out of office, of course. But if you look back at everything they achieved in those 39 months, it was really astounding. And we wanted to put that on the record beyond the fact that it was voted out and was a wild time. And I think that resonated with people. And, you know, time makes people reassess certain situations and certain events. And I think the Barrett government just called out for a reassessment. And you went back and looked at the record. It's a pretty impressive one. And I think a lot of people, as I say, we're interested to read that and to be reminded of what a wild and wonderful time it was.
Yeah, and it sold well, and the critical response was good too, wasn't it?
It was. We got very positive reviews, and it won the BC Book Prize for nonfiction, so that was nice.
Yeah.
And in BC terms, it was a bestseller.
Yeah. How did this book come out? This new book, because it's one of those things where we were talking just before we started about the Paul Phillips book, and that was about 50 years ago.
Yes, that's the thing. This is a book about the history of the BC labor movement, and Paul Phillips' book, which you mentioned, and not that many people know about it, called No Power Greater, is really the only sort of history of the BC labor movement, and that came out in 1967. 50 years ago, which is kind of surprising when you consider how much took place in BC, how much unions did and fought and struggled, and really for the longest time, BC had the most militant labor movement in the country. And, you know, with all those events and strikes and struggles and things, the setbacks and everything, it's an incredibly rich history. It's surprising, really, that not more, like, there haven't been other histories. Now, there are lots of papers and books on specific events and specific individuals. I wouldn't say lots, but certainly there are some.
Yeah.
But this comprehensive history of the entire labor movement, really, this is the first since Paul Phillips' book in 1967. And without criticizing him, because now having done my own research and so on, it's not all that easy to find stuff out and to compile all these events and put them into a kind of a coherent order. It's not really that readable. I mean, Paul Phillips wasn't a writer, but he did a very good job of putting a lot of things on the record that people don't know about, and I would really recommend his book, really, because it gives you a sense, especially of the early days. And he did it, and no one else had done it before him, and he deserves all the credit in the world for that.
You've got a lot more pictures than he does, though.
Well, yes. I mean, this was the premise from the beginning, that this would be a book with a lot of pictures and a larger book. It's not quite a coffee table book, but it's in that area.
Yeah.
And the pictures are really, if I might say so, as the writer, are really a strong part of the book. There really are some terrific pictures, and it's great. I really think that those pictures add to the book. And if you want to just buy the book for the pictures, it's still money well spent.
Yeah, and you know, so some of these pictures, because I've read nearly everything about Vancouver, about BC history, some of these we haven't seen before too, right?
I agree, and I thought, like, you know, some of them are familiar that I'd seen many, many times before, and I had quite a good person assisting me with the picture selection, Donna Sakuta, and she did a great job of finding pictures that were kind of rare and hadn't seen the light of day before. And so I think people think they know all the pictures because some of them are familiar, will be surprised at some of the photos in this book.
Yeah. So we get a sense as we're reading your book, Rod, just why BC is why it is. And a militant labor movement, I mean, has always been part of BC's identity, hasn't it? I mean, no matter how governments or the media even try to paint it otherwise.
Oh, I think that's accurate. And I got a kick out of it, and I didn't know this before I started looking into things, is that the first workers imported from Scotland as miners, they arrived and almost immediately went on strike, which sort of started the whole tradition, because not because they just wanted to go on strike, but because they found the working conditions and the under which they were expected to work appalling.
Yeah.
And so they said, you know, we're not going to work. And and also with that very first strike, it happened up in Fort Rupert in the northern part of Vancouver Island, when the Hudson's Bay Company were the mine owners of all people, two of them were thrown in jail. So the repression by the state in reaction to a strike also happened right off the bat, and you know, and the rich history unfolded from there. But yes, BC is you know, Quebec has certainly had outbursts of real militant labor history, but I think BC would top Quebec in terms of a concerted, long-time, persistent militant labor movement. Very strong labor movement.
Yeah, and you also get a sense of just how this province evolves, because a lot of those unions had to do with workers who worked in resource industries.
Yeah.
A certain the cannery, for example, that canning fish, I mean, doesn't really happen here anymore.
No.
You see how the province moves to resource extraction and other services. I mean, today, teaching, I mean, that's a very powerful union movement in this province, and you can see how they interact with the politics of the day as well, and that must have been fun to write about the political history of this province and its relationship with labor.
Well, yes, I mean, that is very much a part of it all, and really for the longest time, and maybe even still now, we just finished 16 years of the BC Liberals, who are no fans of labor. Mostly the governments have been opposed to the labor movement, and there have been, you know, clashes, whatever word you, conflict, better word, between unions and the government, because the government is basically almost always on the side of the owners and the companies. And especially in the early days, I mean, this is something that I found surprising, because, you know, as a former labor reporter, I sort of knew something about the struggles of the past and these heroic labor figures, et cetera, et cetera, and, you know, where there'd been clashes with police and so on. And if you look at the early history of British Columbia, almost up to the Second World War, there were all these long, bitter, difficult, tough strikes, and the unions lost just about every single one of them. And that's something that I didn't quite realize, because they found they couldn't win the way the cards were stacked against them. There was no legal compulsion to force companies to recognize the unions. The government always intervened on the side of the companies. As soon as a company was struck, they would hire strikebreakers, and the strikebreakers would be protected by the police and sometimes even the militia. And so, and then the strikers would be blacklisted and discriminated against, so they couldn't work again in their industry or in, at that particular workplace. So it was very, very difficult for them to actually win a strike, because they couldn't put economic pressure on the employers. And the governments of the day were basically, they saw radicals and revolution everywhere, any time a union went on strike, and were basically always on the side of the owners and the company that was being struck. So that led to a lot of, one thing it led to, in addition to, of course, consistently protesting this, was a lot of working people and labor leaders tried to form their own political parties, and the Socialist Party was very strong in the early 20th century, and with some success. I mean, they never formed government or even close to it, but sometime, every now and then they would hold the balance of power and get some reasonable legislation through the House. It's a constant debate, actually, still within the labor movement, is how much they should be political and how much should they just concentrate on their membership and fighting for a better workplace, etc.
Yeah, you profile throughout the book a number of fascinating and important figures in BC history, and you just mentioned, the Socialist Party. I guess Tom Uphill, he was the MLA, right?
I'm laughing because I don't think there was anyone like Tom Uphill.
Yeah, socialist MLA.
Yeah, he was amazing. He was elected first in 1920. And it was part of the one big union movement, and was a very, very strong socialist. And he represented the coal mining area of Fernie, way down in the southeast corner of the province, in East Kootenays. And he was elected election after election up until about 1956, I believe, or was it even longer? Anyway, he just won every election. And, of course, he changed his label. He used to call himself, he'd give himself a socialist party, but it was really Tom Uphill. But he was quite a socialist and quite a radical and a very unusual figure. He was one of a kind. And, how many people know about Tom Uphill? Because he was, for one thing, he was way off in the distant reaches of the province. But, yes, a very, very strong socialist, and was always supported by the miners at the Coal's Nest Pass in that area.
I guess he comes to prominence in 52, was it, when he did hold the balance of power?
Well, that's a very interesting story, and he, in a sense, helped determine the fate of British Columbia, possibly, anyway. We don't know what would have happened if he hadn't, but yes, he was elected once again as the independent in 1952 for that region, and W.A.C. Bennett, running for social credit for the first time, they ended up, after the complicated transferable ballot, with 18 seats. The CCF had, even though they had a larger popular vote than social credit, had 17 seats, and the Liberals and Conservatives had the rest. So it really wasn't a majority for W.A.C. Bennett, but the CCF asked the lieutenant governor, thought they should form government because they basically had the same number of seats as W.A.C. Bennett, and they had a larger popular vote, and at least should be given a try to govern.
Mm-hmm.
But Bennett went to the lieutenant governor and showed a letter from Tom Uphill saying he preferred, or he was kind of supportive of W.A.C. Bennett. Uphill was angry at the CCF, which had run a candidate against him.
Right.
So he was not very happy. So it wasn't as if he gave his full-hearted support to W.A.C. Bennett, but he had written that letter. And W.A.C. Bennett, wily as there ever was a politician, used Uphill's letter as an indication to the lieutenant governor that he could govern because he would have Uphill's support. He didn't really have Uphill's support, but he was able to use that letter as evidence. The lieutenant governor gave W.A.C. Bennett the right to form government, And we all know what happened. Yeah. He governed for another 20 years.
Right.
But
yeah.
if Uphill had been consistently opposed to W.A.C. Bennett and thrown his lot in with the CCF, they would have had the same number of seats of as the Social Credit and a better popular vote and would have had a stronger claim to form government. So there you go. Yes, yeah. Tom Uphill, a pivotal role in B.C.'s political history.
You mentioned W.A.C. Bennett. I guess Bill Bennett had a more hostile relationship to labor than his father.
Oh, right? I don't know about that. W.A.C.
Yeah.
Bennett, I mean, really. I mean, Social Credit in those days was almost constant warfare, especially towards the end. I mean, it was really, really bad. And he just didn't recognize unions, and especially in the public sector. The way he treated civil servants was really quite appalling. But his son, Bill Bennett, also had some astounding fights with unions, as we know, Operation Solidarity and all sorts of stuff like that, because of all the repressive legislation he brought in. And he brought the powerful construction unions to heel,
yeah.
because he was determined to bring in more non-union construction. And he was a tough opponent, Bill Bennett. And basically, he won his fights, but you know, politically, it paid a price. You know, there was a price to pay. But both W.A.C. Bennett and his son were quite hostile to unions, and there were so many pitched battles. And really, the labor movement was harnessed in a way that they during their years that they hadn't been harnessed before. It was a wild and conflict-ridden time, that's for sure. Lots of history to write about there.
Yeah, so
and
you,
fairly recent.
Right. Yeah. And so, speaking of recent history, 1983. You mentioned solidarity.
Yeah.
For a lot of us, I mean, you know, I was one at the time, so I don't really, you know. but you remind us in this book just how you know how that affected the entire province. I mean,
it really did, and really, and you know, something like Operation Solidarity comes along only once. I mean, it was an incredible time because the Social Credit government recently reelected passed 26 bills, and they were repressive in so many areas against unions, against human rights, against tenants. The list went on, and like people just couldn't believe it. They were taken aback, but what it did lead to was this unprecedented organized fight back and protest that did stretch to all across the province, and really it was the most concerted. It was a concerted political protest, I think, in the history of Canada. Now, there's certainly been things like the Winnipeg general strike and so on. You know, there's other instances of concerted fight back, but this went on for 4 months, and the feelings and stretched over an entire province and involved, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And the thing that was different about this Operation Solidarity, and eventually it proved to be, in some ways, it's part of its failure, if you can call it a failure, was the involvement of the community activists and the social groups and social activists, because they formed the Solidarity Coalition on the community issues, who weren't trade union people. And there was they worked together for the longest time. But then right at the end, when the union launched their sort of escalating general strike action, the community groups and the Solidarity Coalition were left out of the equation, and they felt very, very bitter about that. But for those 4 months, really, there was nothing like it before it, nothing like it after it, and really, I don't think anything like it in the history of Canada.
Now, your book is dedicated to someone who played a big part in that. Jack Monroe.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he played a big part in your book, but to Jack Monroe's part in Solidarity, I mean, when you think of that time, you really think of Bennett and you think of Monroe, don't you?
Well, you do, and the Kelowna Accord and Jack Monroe going to see if the escalating general strike could be settled, went to Kelowna. To talk to Bill Bennett to try to see if differences could be resolved. And the settlement, such as it was, which wasn't much, is known as the Kelowna Accord. And it was weak. It was barely anything, to be frank. And Monroe got blamed for that settlement as a total sellout, mm-hmm. Certainly by the community groups and the social activists, and I think a little unfairly, because a lot of the labor movement was in on the final settlement with Bill Bennett, but Monroe was the visible person who was talking to him in his living room, and it's really dramatic event. I mean, the whole province was holding its breath. Would the general strike continue? The ferry workers and the bus drivers were due to go out on Monday. This was a Sunday night. Mm-hmm. So people didn't know what was going to happen. And so Jack took a lot of heat for that, and he didn't help his own cause with a lot of his well-known intemperate language to the community groups and social activists. So he really became a target of their ire, and the ire of a lot of people, somewhat unfairly, and some he brought on himself, to be frank.
He goes into Bennett's bedroom to use the phone, I guess, and then he...
you can't make it up.
Yeah, and he can see Bennett's slippers and his dressing gown. And
I know, and he must have been thinking, "What am I doing here? How did I get here? What? This is crazy."
Yeah.
I mean, it really was an unbelievable time. And sometimes this happens with events that you remember, you forget. Because you remember them, it can't be like the 1930s or something like. But really, just how incredible they were, and what a time that was. And I think most of the people that took part in Operation Solidarity haven't forgotten it, and remember exactly what they did and how they felt and how they may have felt betrayed by the Kelowna Accord and so on. One of the things I point out in the book, however, is I know there was this justified bitterness by the community activists, you know, and people who were fighting on human rights and all those things, tenants' rights and so on, is that And that's tended to cloud the Kelowna Accord or the whole Operation Solidarity and Solidarity Coalition, which is what the community groups gathered under, what they achieved. It was actually a trade union victory because there were really repressive trade union bills that were brought in among those 26 bills, including the right to fire without cause, if you can imagine it, and the stripping of the BCGEU's contract of things like seniority rights and all sorts of stuff. And by the end, those bills basically died. And so the trade union movement was successful in budging the social credit government on the trade union issues. Now, that often gets forgotten because of the bitterness that followed the whole mm-hmm. ending of the protest. But I think it's important to point out that they did force social credit to back off on the trade union issues.
And so I mentioned Monroe. I mean, he's a big guy physically, but larger than life, and,
yes.
and had a big
yes.
part, had a big part in the making of this book, right?
Well, that's right. And people may be surprised to see the book is dedicated to Jack Monroe, because he was always a controversial figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people didn't have much time for Jack, and he didn't have time for them, to be frank. But when he retired, he threw himself into the issue of labor heritage, and Jack always wondered, you know, we teach in the schools about you know, the politicians and the, you know, the businessmen and all these events, and where are the workers that actually helped build the province,
mm-hmm.
or even built the province? And he thought unions and workers should be part of the history of British Columbia, and they. And that should be celebrated and should be remembered and recognized. And so he was instrumental in kind of co-founding the Labor Heritage Center of BC, which commissioned this book. And Jack wanted a book out on the labor history of BC, and he died in 2013 before certainly I got involved and so on. But the Community Savings Credit Union, which was originally started as the IWA's credit union, it's mm-hmm. certainly expanded since then, as a tribute to Jack, have helped finance this book. This book was commissioned by the Labor Heritage Center with the financial assistance of the Community Savings Credit Union, and they did so as a tribute to Jack, and that's why the book is dedicated to Jack for his role, and it was a good role, in labor heritage. A side of Jack that not many people know about, but he was very dedicated to labor heritage, and so the book is rightfully dedicated to him, not for all the things he did as a trade union leader, which were controversial,
yeah.
Some loved him, some hated him, whatever. It was because of his role in and his passion for labor heritage, and that's why this book exists.
Yeah, and to think that if he hadn't thought of that, or you hadn't done this book, I mean, a lot of this history would be gone, right?
I agree. It's really quite a remarkable project, and that's I hadn't really thought about that, but it wasn't a sure thing that this book was inevitable.
Yeah.
And somehow, and I have to pay tribute. I mean, there are certainly others after Jack, because you know he did die in 2013. Others took it on, particularly Ken Nowakowski, who has headed up the Labor Heritage Center and really has been such a strong person in advocating for labor heritage and getting things done. You know, that wasn't Jack's strong point in a way, but Ken has really pushed this along, pushed it forward, and without Ken, a former president of the BC Federation of Labor, BC Teachers Federation, I might say, but that's not, you know, he also believes very strongly in labor heritage, and he was really instrumental in pushing this forward.
The book also, in two areas, I found fascinating. It talks about race and the various groups that come to this province and who are affected by the labor movement. I'm talking about the Japanese, Natives, the Chinese that worked on the railroad, of course, and
South Asians.
Yeah, so the Indo-Canadians, yeah, Sikhs and Indo-Canadians, as they're called today. The role of women too.
Very much so. Yes.
You get a sense of these minorities and their.
Well, you can't call women a minority.
Definitely no.
But I know what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah, these people who are underrepresented, if
yes,
you will,
yes,
really
yes.
find their voice through the labor movement, don't they?
Well, yes and no. Certainly for women, especially now as the private sector unions have diminished for reasons which we can figure out, the disappearance of these large industrial workforces. So the public sector's in the fore, and you know, many of their members are women, and women now represent a majority, I think, of the BC Federation of Labor, members in the BC Federation of Labor. And so it was important, and to I thought, and for the others commissioning the book, to bring forward the role of women in the trade union movement. I mean, they weren't all leaders, but some of them were really as heroic as anyone else. Why not? It's good to point that out, that it wasn't just the preserve of these white male trade union leaders. Now, as far as the Chinese and the Japanese and the, we call them South Asians now, but really, you know, we know who they are, the Sikhs, as we used to call them.
Uh-huh.
They were subjected to terrible racism of the time. And, you know, a lot of the union leaders called for Asian exclusion and a stop to immigration because they regarded them as a threat to their jobs, because of course they were exploited by the owners and the companies and paid less, and they were often used as, especially the Chinese, not so much the Japanese and the South Asians, but were hired as strike breakers, and they had no status in the country, and so they were often under the heel of unscrupulous labor contractors too, who said, if you don't work here, you'll be deported.
Yeah.
So, and really for the longest time, into the 1930s, there was, extensive racism by the trade union movement towards Chinese, Japanese, and South Asian workers, particularly towards the Chinese. But we also know what happened to the Japanese during the Second World War with internment.
Right.
So that was always there, and that's an unfortunate part of the labor movement. It's not really an excuse, but it should be pointed out that a lot of society was on the same page as that. And there was, you know, the politicians were terribly racist. And really, it's a shameful part of Canada's history. And a lot of trade unionists were part of that.
Yeah.
Now, it's also right to point out that not all trade unionists were like that. Some saw clearly that the issue was not race, but class. And the Chinese were workers too, and they should be, and the Japanese and so on, and they should be organized too. And that's the way you solve the problem, is by organizing them into your union. But those views didn't prevail. But there were trade unionists who were far sighted enough to see that and opposed the racism of the past, and one of them was the IWW, the Radical Industrial Workers of the World, who took everybody into their ranks. Didn't matter what race or whatever, you could become a member of the IWW, and they were, you know, ahead of their time in that regard.
You know, your book, Rod, as we're reading it, reminds us that there's a lot of history that you know, these gaps in our history that we need to fill in, and your book fills in a lot of those. But I mean, at the same time, there are a lot of people who think that the time of unions has passed, and as I hear that, I tend to think that's because we've taken them for granted in a way, haven't we?
I completely agree with that. We have taken it for granted, and you know, with all these things that unions, you know, these people that say, oh yeah, unions were good back in the 1930s or 1940s, but now we don't need them. You know, they're too powerful or whatever they are. And, you know, we forget how much we owe to the unions and their sacrifice and struggles, because as I mentioned earlier, they lost most of these strikes. They were blacklisted. Some paid with their lives. They were beaten up, and they kept getting up off the mat to fight for these things that we now take for granted today, including the eight-hour day, you know, overtime, weekends, vacations, pensions, you know, health and safety in the workplace, equal pay for equal work, you know, an end to child labor, and so on. And these are things that it wasn't just the, you know, they still had to be passed by legislation and so on, but these were things that were never given up voluntarily by employers. They had to be fought for and taken, and so that there's, in some ways, we do take that for granted and forget how much a part unions played in the conditions that we take for granted today. And now it is difficult for unions these days because the nature of the workforce has changed so much. I mean, they're still very strong in the public sector, but in the private sector, it's very tough because these, you know, in BC, they're built by private sector unions and members in these large workforces in the mines and in the smelters and the forests and so on. When I started as a labor reporter, the IWA had like more than 50,000 members in BC, and now it's like around 10,000, and that's happened in the resource industries. And so it's difficult. There's more part-time jobs, jobs are contracted out, low-paid service jobs, and so on. And it's tough for unions. And I would argue, though, they're probably needed more than ever because of the people are working more than ever. Speaking of more than ever, I mean, it's amazing to me, who's been around for a long time. This, you know, I remember a time when people thought of a big problem would be all this leisure time we were going to have with automation and technology, but
right.
It's been exactly the reverse.
Yeah.
People are working longer and harder, and where's that at? You know, it's very strange, and one of the ways, I mean, unions have been around for a long time. I mean, what else has been around as long as unions as a kind of a social cohesive institution? Not much. Lots have fallen by the wayside. The unions are still with us. And it's not going to be easy for them, but I think they still have a role to play.
Right.
And to keep the pressure on and to remember that, you know, ordinary workers are people too and want decent lives. And unions can go to bat for them.
Now, I guess from people I've talked to over the last little bit, they think that the NDP government here in British Columbia lasts till 2021. You remind us in the book that even though there are NDP governments in office, that doesn't mean that there's labor peace in the province.
It sure doesn't,
yeah.
Especially during the Barrett years, which was a big part of our book on the Barrett years.
Right.
I mean, there was a lot of warfare between the NDP government at the time, Barrett, and a large segments of the labor movement. I mean, the NDP eventually ordered back 50,000 private sector workers back on their jobs, and like nothing like that has happened in Canada, really. They might have been right to have done that, but that was really tough. And there were certainly conflicts within the NDP government in the 1990s, less so. Mm-hmm. And there will probably be conflict now with the current NDP government, because the labor movement isn't one, you know, solid mass of opinion. I mean, that's another thing about the book. You read this book, you'll see lots of divisions within the labor movement as people take different views. And you don't think that they're split on the environment? You know, lots of trade unionists oppose Site C or oppose, you know, and the NDP is going ahead with that. Construction unions are happy with it, but a lot of unionists are not happy. And the BC Federation of Labor, their members are split on it, you know. And so we've got that. It is no guarantee. People think that, you know, oh, the NDP's in, it's going to, the province is going to be run by big unions. I mean, it's often trotted out against the BC against the BC NDP, and really, if you know the reality of this situation, that's hardly the way it is. I mean, they prefer, unions, let's face it, prefer the NDP, because it's far more friendly to unions than, say, the BC Liberals. But that doesn't mean it's going to be clear sailing. There will be hiccups along the way, because first and foremost, the labor movement represents its members. It doesn't you know, it doesn't just go to bat for the NDP and do the NDP's bidding, or vice versa, because the NDP has a duty to the voters and to ordinary British Columbians, not to the labor movement.
Yeah. It's nice talk. I could talk all day with you about this book, because there's just so much in here, and I'm looking at my sheet. There's stuff that I haven't touched on. It's nice talking in. You've done a great service with this book.
Thank you.
Good luck with it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I really do. Can I make one last plug for the book?
Yes, please.
One of the things I tried to do, and I think is relatively new, is to bring in the history of First Nations as workers, which happened during the 19th century, and people are, and I was unaware of it. And who else was here to do the work? It was the First Nations people, the Indigenous people, and they were glad to do it and to get the wages, which could improve their lives somewhat. And so they were in the early mines, in the early mills, and on the docks, and in the canneries, and doing the fishing, harvesting the hops. All these things were done by a lot of First Nations people, and the book has tried to point that out, and then how they were deliberately eased out of the workforce, and you know, and in place of white workers, and which compounded their tragedy of what happened to them, but. I think the book is interesting to that extent, that you'll find out stuff about Indigenous workers that you didn't know in the early history of British Columbia.
Indeed, indeed. Thanks again, Rod.
Thank you, my friend. I really appreciate your kind comments.
The book is called On the Line, A History of the British Columbia Labor Movement. It's published by Harbor. Its author, Rod Mickleburg, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.